This week's episode is brought to you by Audible.com. Audible is the leading provider of audiobooks with more than 100,000 downloadable titles across all types of literature, including fiction, nonfiction, and periodicals. For a free audiobook of your choice, go to audiblepodcast.com/bookhype. Hey everyone, welcome to our latest episode of Book Hype. I'm Jen, and today I'm joined by Marima, Mikhail, and Karen. Hello, ladies.
Hello. Hey.
And today we are going to discuss 17 and Gone by Novarun Suma, which is a really cool book if you guys haven't read it. It's definitely worth checking out. But first, we're going to talk a little bit about Book Bites, which is our quick topic of discussion before we get into our big discussion. So today's book bite is novella, or the novella. How do you guys feel about novellas? They seem to be on the rise lately, and you get novellas in between books, you get novellas that are prequels, you get novellas that are free as gifts from the author, but then you also get novellas that you're expected to pay for. So how do you guys feel about the novella and what the publishing industry is utilizing it for?
I really like them. I think it's cool when authors release them as extra material because it's always interesting to get like background stories on certain characters or what happens in between two novels. I think that works out really well. And also, it's a really quick read, so you can get through a bunch of novellas and feel like you've really accomplished a lot of reading, and it doesn't take that long.
Yeah, I'm kind of the same, I guess. Although I don't tend to read that many novellas now that I've never really thought about it before, but now that I'm thinking about it, I only read them, I guess, by authors that I'm interested in, like a supplementary material to maybe a pre-existing world or something like that, which is actually really stupid now that I think about it, because it's kind of a perfect way to find out if you like an author's writing or not. So I feel like that would be more useful if I actually read them that way. But yeah, it mainly just seems like kind of promo things and extra stories and stuff, which if I like someone's writing or I enjoy the world or the characters that they're writing, then I'm happy to pay for a, you know, a short story. I don't see any issue with them not being free.
I feel differently about this, and this is really just an emotional reaction, but I sort of feel like novellas from authors like this are cheating a little bit. Like, I kind of don't want the deleted scene experience. I don't want, you know, the other stuff. I almost feel like if it couldn't make it into the published book, then I don't want it. You know, it's like that's the chance that the author and the publishers got to excite me and you know, thrill me and hook me. And I sort of feel like, oh, you know, see from this character's perspective is like, but that's not the point, though. That's not the story you're telling. You're telling the story of, like, Triss in Divergent, that it's her story. It's not Four's story. And when, you know, we get these other stories, like, that's great, but it's sort of like, well, then what exactly is the world of Divergent? Like, why should I be as interested in Four as I am in Triss? And I mean, I know that's kind of cynical, but I just feel like sort of publicity driven, and I think it's genuine. Like, I don't think these authors are like, oh my god, you know, like pulling these stories out of nowhere. But I do kind of feel like the book is what they get, you know. And I guess I'm just a traditionalist in that way. But
see, I like them because you get different perspectives, especially if you're reading a book that's in first person, like this deluxe series by Jennifer Larmentrout. There's a novella that comes with it that's actually like a prequel novella told from someone else's point of view, and it gives you a whole different perspective on the events that happen in the book after you've already read through, because that came out after the first three books in the series. So I think it's really effective in a lot of ways. What I find odd sometimes is that if it's meant to happen between books or as part of a book and it's only like, you know, 30 pages long, and they're trying to charge you like $3 for it, that I find a little bit off-putting, because I feel like it's just a tool to make more money. But when like an author writes it and it's free, or if it's like 99 cents, then that makes more sense to me. But when it's like hiked up to $3 and $4, I feel like that's kind of like a tool just to make more money and not necessarily meant to progress the story or anything like that. So that's where I find issue with them sometimes. But overall, I like when they add stuff into the world so that you have kind of different perspectives and a different angle to look at the story from.
So really, you like the novellas that give you the Midnight Sun experience, is what you're trying to say.
No, not really.
That's right, I know Twilight references. I still judge you, but I get what you're saying.
Well, that basically was like telling me the same story from a different character's point of view, which is not what I like. I like it when you have the moments that are off screen and you know something's happened, but you only see it through the first person point of view. So you get that other person's perspective of what happened off the page or of a scene, you know what I mean? That they weren't there
deleted
for.
Scenes.
Yeah. More that respect than tell me the same story. I already know. I just need to know his emotions now. No, that's lame.
I think I like them more when it's more of like a tangential kind of thing. Like if it's, you have your main story and your main characters and like, that's great. And then they write a little novella of like just some secondary character that you didn't know much about. Just because it often gives you a different perspective into the world that you wouldn't get if it was one of the main characters that are sort of interacting with each other. And then it's it also means that it's not essential for readers to buy it if they're not that interested in, like, oh, well, you know, I really like this story, but I am only interested in Triss or in Katniss or whatever. You know, I don't care about so-and-so off in the background. But then the readers that are interested in getting that, like, broader experience of the world can buy it if they choose to.
See, and that was what I was trying to say, but you just said it much more
efficiently. Oh, sorry.
No, that's fine. I was like, how do I explain it? Oh, wait, I'm just going to let Marma do it.
Oh,
perfect. No. Yeah, but that's kind of the idea. So that you get a more diverse look at the world, which I think is always important. Because if you're existing in a first-person world, then you only see that person's perspective of the world, which can be jaded and can be skewed a certain way in order for that story to be told. So
point, you know, I feel like the author chose to write the story in first person, you know, with all the benefits and, you know, detriments of that form, and they should have to stick to it. Like, I feel like they shouldn't get that novella to be like, but this is what this person was really thinking, like you know, in Song of Ice and Fire, like, we have point of view characters, and then everybody else is like, we have to kind of guess a little bit, and that's sort of the point, you know, that I mean, it's not cheating, but I do kind of feel like it's, like, taking advantage, or trying to subvert the, I don't know, I'm probably thinking about this way more than the authors and publishers do, but I do kind of feel like, you have to do it on the first try, you know, in terms of the book, and, you know, like you guys were saying, like a background novella or something that's like, here's what was going on with Piglet while Eeyore and Pooh and Christopher Robin were having an adventure. Like, it's slightly different. But yeah, that's my cynical thoughts.
I think we all actually agree. We're just saying it in different ways.
Okay, well, that's good.
Yeah, no, Mikhail, I totally agree with that. Like, there's a really great Melina Marchetta novella, and I can't remember what it's called for the life of me, but it's set in her Lumetaire Chronicles, the fantasy trilogy that she wrote. And basically it's about this side character who goes off, and the end result of the novella is like the character steals this book, basically, and her stealing the book is mentioned as like a one-line kind of throwaway in the series, so you don't need to read the novella to like understand what's going on. But if you read the novella, it's a kind of cool thing of being like, oh, that's how she got the book, and, you know, oh, it's interesting. Whereas there was that, oh, I can't remember what the author's name is, Kira Cass, that writes the
Selection.
Yeah, and whatever the second one was, I can't remember. The Elite, and she wrote the novella from the prince's perspective. I don't know if anyone read that, and it was like Midnight Sun. And it was the same thing. I was like, but why do I care what he thinks? Like, I don't. It's from the girl's perspective. So yeah, I think it goes both ways.
Yeah, I mean, the one downside to that is that while I do agree that it's fair, I don't find myself as interested in what a side character is doing. Like, I probably would be if I just picked up the novella, but in my head, I'm not like, oh, I really want to read that. You know, it's sort of like, oh, well, maybe I'll check it out. And I leave it in my Goodreads line and then don't click on it. But that's just for me. That's not like from a I disapprove standpoint.
Okay.
So, yay, agreement.
So let's talk about
never happened.
What we're what we're reading now.
I read, like, a million books. I just finished Planet Thieves by Dan Krokos, which was really cute. It's like a middle grade space adventure. And I'm also reading the second Legend by Marie Lu. I think that's what the second one's called.
No, the second one is Prodigy.
Oh, right, Prodigy. Right, the series is called Legend. So I'm reading Prodigy by Marie Lu, and I'm reading at the same time Mistborn by Brandon Sanderson, because all my friends were like, you have to read this book. And then they were like, you haven't read this book? So I was like, okay, I'll read this book.
Yeah, I'm the same. I'm reading like 1,000 things right now, but let me pick my favorites. Definitely The Diviners by Libba Bray. I recently read that, and that is like really, really great. It's set in 1920s New York, and it's like a supernatural mystery thriller thing with like prohibition and stuff. It's way cool. And I've also been reading a lot of things by Australian authors. So I don't know if you guys can get these in America yet, but Australian people, go buy these books. Fairy Tales for Wild Girls by Elise Neer, I just read. And it's kind of like a twisted fairy tale thing. If you liked like Neil Gaiman or Miss Peregrine's, you would definitely be into this book. It's one of the better twisted fairy tales that I've read for a while. So those two, I recommend those.
Right now, I am reading The Game Board of the Gods by Rochelle Mead, and it's really weird. I don't know how I feel about it quite yet. I'm about halfway through with it, and it's her adult novel, and it's interesting. I haven't read The Vampire Academy or anything like that, so I'm not totally sure how I feel about her writing, and I wasn't necessarily a fan before I read this, so I don't know. We'll see. I'll let you guys know if I end up enjoying it by the end of it.
Funny you should mention Rochelle Mead, because I, in the last week and a half, have read both the Vampire Academy and Bloodline series. I've read them all, because I'm now on vacation, so I have lots of reading time, and I have to say, they're actually really good. Other than some, like, you know when you get into a new book in the series and they'll bring something up that happened in the last book and there's, like, that moment where they have to retell you what happened? I really hate that. And there's some of that in the first, like, three books of the Vampire Academies. There's a lot of that going on, which is really annoying. But other than that, they're actually, the story itself is really well thought out and the mythology is really cool. And I'm also reading Untold by Sarah Rhys Brennan, which is the second novel in the Lindburn Legacies. And then I'm also reading Dream Thieves by Maggie Stiefvater, which is the second book in the Raven Cycle. So I'm like power reading whatever I can get my hands on at this point in time.
The repetition in the vampire books is probably like more so seeing as you read them all in like a week. You're like, I know what happened, guys. I just read this book.
Probably. But like, it's definitely there more than in most books. And you can see by the time you get to the Bloodline series, it's not nearly, because that's a spin-off series with some of the characters from the original series. So it's significantly less in those books. I feel like she just got a better editor. Or somebody caught on to the fact that, oh, we don't need to retell quite so much now that we're, you know what I mean? It was significantly better. So it's I didn't feel it was so much a writing choice as an editing choice. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah. I've been meaning to read those Bloodlines books for ages. I should get onto that.
They're actually pretty good. I really like them. They're quicker than the Vampire Academy books. They're shorter. But I mean, they're really cool. And the mythology she's built into these stories is very different from your traditional vampire mythology, which is also super enjoyable.
Cool.
Yeah.
It's really funny about her because I went to an event in the Union Square Barnes & Noble a couple weeks ago, and I was going for Rick Yancey and also Marie Lu. So it was her, Marie Lu, Rick Yancey, Sarah Dessen, and Andrea Kramer.
Oh, yeah.
And all of the audience questions were for Rochelle Mead. It was kind of hilarious.
She's, like I said before, she's significantly more popular than I originally thought. Like, I knew that the Vampire Academy series was kind of popular, but I had no idea to the extent of the popularity until we started covering it.
Yeah. I feel like it came out of nowhere almost, although I know it was there the whole time.
Right.
But
until that whole movie thing came up, it was like, whoa. So I'm really curious about all of that, the whole movie thing and like where she goes next with stuff. And because she's still writing in the Bloodline series, which is really cool. So while the movie's being filmed, there are characters that appear in the Bloodline series that are now cast, which I think is a really interesting thing too, to have pictures of these people in your head that you're writing about. So.
Yeah, I'm, like, really curious to see how this movie goes. It's been getting a lot of good hype, though.
Yeah, it's Weinstein Company. They usually do pretty well, so...
I know, and, like, all the fans were really into the cast I saw, so...
Yeah, and the cast is unknown. Like, Zoe Deutsch has been in a couple things. Her mom is Leah Thompson. But other than, like, Gabriel Byrne and Jolie Richards, who are two adult characters that are not massively involved in the plot. I mean, they are, but not on screen as much. All the cast that is primary is basically unknown.
Yeah, so. Which is a good move, probably.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, probably. So it'll be interesting to see how that kind of all plays out, the closer we get to release and the closer we get to actually seeing some footage. So today's episode is brought to you by Audible.com, the internet's leading provider of audiobooks with more than 100,000 downloadable titles across all types of literature, including audio versions of many New York Times bestsellers. For listeners of Book Hype, Audible is offering you a free audiobook to give you a chance to try out their very helpful service. Today, we are recommending The Vampire Academy by Rochelle Mead. The novel takes place at a private school in Montana and is the basis of the movie coming out, The Vampire Academy. The mythology and legends within the story are vastly different from most vampire stories, and it's an exceptionally good read. Definitely check it out. Again, visit audiblepodcast.com/bookhype to get an audiobook for absolutely free. We thank Audible for their support of the show. Okay, now we're going to get on with the discussion of 17 and Gone, which we have all read, and I think for the most part we all enjoyed it. So why don't we talk about our overall rating for the book? Is it a definitely read, a borrow from the library?
I like that rating system. That's cool.
Yeah, me too.
Yeah, that's cool. What was the middle one? Borrow from the library?
Yes.
I think borrow from the library for me. I enjoyed it, but if I had bought it, which I didn't, by the time I got to the end of it, I think I would have been like a bit, oh, well, that was a waste of money. So if you borrow it, then you wouldn't have that feeling of, oh, I wish I had given my money to someone else. Like, it wasn't bad, and I enjoyed parts of it, but it left me feeling a bit just, I don't know, just nothing at the end. It didn't leave a very strong impression on me. So, yeah, I think borrow. But it's worth reading for sure.
Okay, I guess I'll come in as the positive one again. I would definitely go out and buy this book. That's my suggestion. I loved it. It's actually one of my favorite books that I've read so far this year. And it just really surprised me. I didn't see the twist coming, and it kind of blew my mind. And I've never read anything by this author before, and I thought her writing was fantastic, and I really enjoyed it, and I know I'm going to be tracking down some of her other books and picking up those as well.
I'm conflicted on this book because I think it's objectively pretty good. Like, objectively, if you like this style of book, and I guess we'll discuss what that style of book is, then I think it's probably worth a buy. Maybe a paperback buy, but still a buy. For me personally, I think this was a wait till you can get it for free, because I don't really like books. Well, I mean, I've said this before on the podcast, I don't like real books, and this is kind of a real book. I don't like books with unreliable narrators. I don't like books where you can't really tell what's going on until the very end. So this isn't like a comment on like, oh, this is a horrible book and no one should read it at all. But for me, it didn't really do the trick.
Okay, see, I am not like you, Mikhail. I don't mind unreliable narrators. I always think the story makes for an interesting story that way. So I would say buy the book, because I think the research that went into this novel and then the writing style itself, Nova Rinzuma has this amazing way with words and how she writes and describes and how she puts things together. And I'm kind of a fan of that. Just her writing in general is really beautiful. So I think that this is a by the book. And I agree with Karen in the fact that it's just very unique and different and all of that stuff. So let's talk about the writing actually a little bit. How did you guys feel about like the general, the style and how she writes in general? Anyone have any strong feelings about that?
I loved it. I think she, like you said, she has a way with words that I guess I wasn't really expecting. I mean, there are a lot of books out there that the writing is good and it's fine. You know, I don't really pick up on the stylistic choices that the author makes, but for her, I really zeroed in, like, all of her metaphors and stuff were beautiful, and she has a way of concisely sort of giving you this picture of what's going on without having to talk about it for 8 pages, and I think that is the mark of a really strong writer, and yeah, like I said, her writing is basically the reason why I would go out and find her other books.
Yeah, the writing is definitely beautiful. Like, I don't have a problem with that. I never felt at all like I was being written down to or anything was simplified. Like, I don't know if she's capable of simplifying as a writer. Once or twice, I mean, this might just be my, you know, along the same lines as the unreliable narrator thing, I sort of wish she would just get to the point and, you know, kind of finish up with the metaphors. But again, that's a personal thing. I think if you're looking for something that definitely plays with language and doesn't write in a typical, I was going to say typical YA, but I don't even think this is typical for adult novels. I mean, this is very artistic and very kind of conceptual. I agree. It's definitely worth a look if you want a very different kind of almost experimental experience. But the writing is definitely, I think, one of the draws to the book.
Well, I feel bad now because I read this book like 3.5 weeks ago, so I can't remember exactly. But I wasn't like, I guess I didn't know it much going into it, but if I had heard Karen and Mikhail's descriptions of her writing and then read the book, I would have been underwhelmed. I didn't feel like it was anything amazingly original or anything. It was a bit heavy on the metaphor, but it was fine. It was, you know, it was interesting. It wasn't poorly written. Nothing that stood out to me, though.
And how did you guys feel about the character? Lauren is our main character, and she has these, you know, quote-unquote waking nightmares that start to haunt her. And it starts off with just one girl, and then it becomes a vast number of girls, and they're in this place, and she feels that they've been kidnapped. So what did you guys think about the character of Lauren and how she developed throughout, and how the quote-unquote lost girls kind of developed throughout?
I think she's kind of unlikable. I don't know if that was just me. So someone needs to, like, back me up here. But definitely at the start of the book, I don't think the author goes out of her way to make you feel sympathy for Lauren. Like, she's kind of annoying about this crusade of her things that she's on. And again, maybe that was my slight disconnect from the writing style. But she just kind of goes on and on about these things. And, like, I get it. Girls, she thinks the girls are disappearing and the girls are dying. And, like, obviously that's incredibly sad. And to her, it feels very personal. But I wasn't until we got into probably, like, the last third of the book that I felt any real, even empathy for Lauren as a character. Before that, yeah, like, I was happy to read it because the story was interesting. But her as a character, I didn't find myself being drawn to in a positive way.
I completely agree, actually, that Lauren is sort of an unlikable character. And I think it's funny that the ghosts kind of had more personality than she did. They really sort of stuck out in my mind a lot more than the narrator did. But at the same time, I don't really think the author could do much about that because of the story that was being told. You know, she couldn't exactly make Lauren like this super bubbly person or somebody with like a very strong kind of positive personality. So I can see why Lauren was the way that she was, But yeah, I didn't really feel too much for her until the end either, and I actually quite liked the Lost Girls a lot more than I liked Lauren.
Yeah, I totally agree. Sorry, I should clarify. I don't think that's anything wrong with the novel that she was unlikable. I don't think a character needs to be likable for you to enjoy a book. And it probably would have defeated the purpose if, yeah, like you said, she'd been super cheerful and whatever, because obviously she needed to be semi-alienated and, you know. But yeah, it was funny. All of the girls, even though they were the quote-unquote supporting characters, seemed to have a lot more personality, which I guess makes sense once you get to the reveal at the end of the book.
Yeah, I think that something about the book, and I'm not sure if this is good or bad, was that it wasn't so much about Lauren's development as it was her kind of de-evolution, because she sort of becomes a conduit for the other girls, and that's really all she is. And you only get very small glimpses of what her life used to be like. You know, she says, like, I think she has a line in the beginning about when she's like initially, you know, looking at Abby, and, you know, she's kind of like talking about not being late for school or something like that. And, you know, before things changed and it was a while ago, but I think there was something like that. And, you know, and you get an indication that she had a fairly healthy relationship with Jamie, but it's the way we're dealing with Lauren is not as someone who is growing as a character. It's someone who's getting lost. And that is definitely really interesting, but it also can be hard to connect to.
I think that's a really good point, Mikkel, about how she's, you know, most YA books focus on a character, and you watch them from one point to the next where they're growing and moving forward in their lives and, you know, discovering new things, whereas Lauren's actually, like, moving backward and delving much deeper into things that one wouldn't expect. So I think that that's a very valid point, and I think it's what makes her character diverse and interesting, but at the same time, unlikable, as you guys pointed out. So all very good points. How about the pacing of the novel? How did you guys feel when you were reading it? Did you feel like it got bogged down or too stuck up on one thing or another? Or did you guys think it was pretty solid?
Too slow. Like, way too slow. It was way too long. It needed editing. That's what it was like 350 pages or something. And it didn't need to be. And I honestly think someone going into reading this, when you have a character like Lauren that is so unlikable and would be quite alienating to a lot of readers, I think, and you're kind of not sure what's going on with the plot and it's slow, it would be so off-putting to a lot of readers, which would be a shame because I think by the time you get to the end, it picks up and it gets a lot better. But when the Abby thing starts and it's like, oh, you know, Jamie doesn't understand and blah, 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 and slowly, slowly you get these new girls and then it picks up. It's just so slow at the start. Like, the first half of it could be half as long.
Yeah, I agree. I think I wanted to know what was going on really badly, and I think that's what really kept me going as I read it, but it took such a long time for each little clue to be discovered and revealed. And I think, yeah, like you said, the first half probably could have been cut in half, and I think it would have made the book a lot stronger, and maybe even, you know, for some of the people that might not enjoy this book, it would have probably given them a better response if it hadn't been quite as long and slow.
Yeah, I mean, I guess I agree. I read this book in bits and pieces, so I wasn't as challenged by the pace, but I agree. If she'd gotten to kind of the world of the other girls and kind of the problem that was being tackled a little faster, it might have been helpful. Yeah, I mean, I don't have any major thoughts on it, though.
Okay. Now, this is the part where we're going to talk about the twist. So if you have not read the book, don't listen any further, because we're going to give away all the good parts. That is my only disclaimer. So the twist, did you guys see it coming, and were you disappointed that the ghosts weren't real?
Can I make a confession?
Sure.
I was getting so frustrated with the mystery, and again, I don't know if this is, like, the book or just me, because I don't really like mysteries, but I was so bothered with not knowing what was going on that I skipped to the end. And
you didn't!
I did.
Oh my god. But, get off this podcast.
I know, bad. But at the same time, it made the rest of the book a lot more readable because I was kind of able to contextualize everything and be like, oh, well, this is because she's schizophrenic. And, you know, it was much less of a, I mean, I guess of a mystery, but at the same time, it kind of helped me contextualize what was going on. So, I mean, I had an inkling, like, I thought going in that this was going to be like a mystery and like a supernatural mystery and like who's kidnapping these girls? Like, is it a boogeyman or a ghoul or something? And it definitely wasn't that. But you know, as I kind of realized that further and further, I got more and more, I guess taken into like what is actually going on. And I just had to know. So I guess that's a good thing that I absolutely had to know, but I think looking back on it, I probably had some kind of idea that it was something with Lauren and less something with the world. But it wasn't especially like a blazing sign like, oh, she's mentally ill. This is the thing.
I did not see the twist coming at all. It completely knocked me off my feet. And I mean, I think I read this book, I don't even know if I read the back cover when I picked it up. So I went in completely, like, not knowing anything about it. And so, yeah, the twist really sort of blew my mind. And I thought it was a supernatural mystery, too. For quite a while, even when she was in the hospital, I was sort of rebelling against the idea that it was anything but a supernatural mystery. And I think that's one of the strongest pulls to this book, is that she really puts you in Lauren's shoes. And I don't know about you guys, but I actually felt like I was going crazy as I was reading this book because I was like, no, these girls are real. Like, she's not crazy. She's really seeing these things. Why isn't anybody believing her? And then you get to the end of the book and you find out she's schizophrenic and you're like, oh my God, you know, I really kind of know what it feels like for somebody like this now. And I guess I was a little disappointed that the ghosts weren't real because I wanted there to be a sort of happy ending. I'm definitely a happy ending kind of person, but at the same time, I think the portrayal of Lauren and her schizophrenia was so strong and so real that I kind of didn't mind that it didn't pan out exactly how I was sort of hoping it was from the beginning.
Oh, I'm the opposite, as usual. I was the same as you, Karen. I didn't know anything much about the book going into it, and I read it all in one go. So I didn't have any, like, preconceptions of whatever was coming. But I'm really glad that it turned out to be the schizophrenia, because if it had been, like, a supernatural, you know, ghost, whatever, clairvoyant, I don't know, whatever you want to call it, thing, it would have just felt like such a cop-out. There are so many books with those kinds of elements in it now, and there aren't that many books that are being written set in like the real world, quote unquote. So I'm glad that it took that turn. And like, just pragmatically, if it had been a supernatural thing, like, I have no idea how you would have solved that in the end. You know, like, oh, magically the girls went away. So, you know, and this kind of, the book needed the twist like this. I think if it had just kept going on the way that it was, it wouldn't have been much of a story, because there wasn't a huge amount of plot there, so to speak, because it really is about Lauren's kind of descent into this this illness that, you know, she starts to show symptoms at the start of the story. And I think at the start of the story you could read it thinking, yeah, it is supernatural, but the more you get into it and the more girls that appear, and I think I felt it especially with the neighbor, Fiona, is that Fiona? With her, you start to feel like something isn't quite right here, and this isn't just about ghosts or spirits or whatever. There's something that's not quite adding up with Lauren. And and so once they have the reveal, it makes sense. And you think back on the rest of the book and you think, oh, yeah, like a lot of that makes a lot more sense now. And I think it made it a much more interesting story from a character side as well, because there really is only one character. And gave us something to do. So I appreciated that.
No, I actually agree with that if it had just been a supernatural mystery, it would have been a cop-out. But the book is actually stronger because of the twist and because it was sort of like a real-life kind of book. It didn't have any supernatural elements to it. And I was definitely kind of disappointed at first when we first got that reveal that they weren't real. And I think that was only because I felt for the Lost Girls so much that I wanted their ghosts to be real and I wanted, like, that whole thing to be resolved. But then finishing the book and sort of thinking about it afterwards, I really enjoy how it ended, even though it wasn't really a happy ending. But, yeah, I just think it was stronger because of that rather than if it had just been a straight supernatural mystery.
I mean, I agree with you guys on a lot of those points, especially because we are inundated with the supernatural mystery stories. Like, they're just, you can, you know, throw a stone in a bookstore and you're going to hit 10 of them. So I think it's really important that this book kind of looks like a supernatural mystery until you really delve into it and read it. And then you get so much more out of it because of the twist and because of the way she depicts the schizophrenia in the book. I think that it was masterfully done. Like, trying to show schizophrenia and how it evolves and how it takes over someone is impossible unless you really research and know a lot about it and things like that, because it's one of those mental illnesses that is just pictured a certain way for a lot of people. You know, they mix it up with multiple personality disorder and all of these other things. So I think that what she did and how she created this story was incredibly well done and a really important thing to do, because there aren't a lot of books out there that depicts mental illness in any way, never mind in a way that's almost understandable. So I think that it was really well done in that respect, and that it was important to create the book the way that she did.
I think what kind of maybe confused me a little bit, even though, again, in retrospect, it does make sense. Like, even as far as the title, you know, you get the sense that there is something that happens when girls turn 17. And it's, you know, that she says, I think, a couple of times in the book, you know, you turn 17 and you disappear, or there's this darkness that can take you. And, you know, you kind of really, it really kind of leads you to think that there is this, I don't know, like, sociological, mythical phenomenon that takes over girls when they turn 17 and that makes them especially vulnerable. Even if the way that they are being kidnapped might be mundane, you know, you kind of, she makes you connect it to something bizarre and supernatural. I think it's interesting that the title is what it is, because the title still kind of calls back to that idea. But at the same time, I mean, I don't have a problem with it, you know.
I think you're right. The title and the way that the book is set up, it's definitely intended to lead you towards that conclusion. And I guess that's because they think it will make the reveal stronger, because it will be, instead of thinking, oh, I'm not quite sure what's going on, you kind of do form a definite idea about, well, this must be a kind of quasi-supernatural something, and then it's not at all. So, you know, it gives you the contrast, I guess. But they're definitely leading you down that path, or trying to, at least at the start.
Yeah, but I mean, I agree with you, Marama, that the incident with Fiona kind of seems a little jarring in this, like, when you're with Abby and, like, she's taking over Abby's body and she's, you know, doing all this crazy stuff. And then she has this almost very lucid memory of a massive trauma that happened to her. And in retrospect, it becomes very clear that this is what, not necessarily that triggered, but maybe that defined the way that her mental illness would progress. So, looking back, that made it a little bit more clear. And I agree that it's funny because the book kind of gives you conflicting signals. And again, I think most of this is probably intentional, but that you have this, you know, there really isn't anything. I don't remember there being anything bizarre about other than, you know, the situation itself, but there doesn't seem to be anything magical about the way Fiona left. But, you know, everything else is, you know, she's communing with these spirits in this house and she's having dreams and, you know, nobody's listening. And it's all, you know, it's like there's a weird static in the book, you know, that's kind of between you and the real meaning. And you get glimpses of one meaning and you get glimpses of another. And then in the end, like, you find out which one is real, but at the same time, you almost don't because Fiona is still there.
Yeah, that's like a separate issue, I think, the ending. But I agree with you. It feels like there's sort of a disconnect both between the reader and the story and also between, like, the story that you're being presented with and the story of what is actually going on, which you can't be fully aware of until you've read the whole book. So it's kind of a book that almost requires a reread, I think. It would be interesting. I haven't read it twice, but it would be interesting to go back and read it in hindsight, knowing how it ends.
Mm-hmm. But I think in almost a sense, that's sort of the point, because that's what it's like to be schizophrenic. You don't connect. You have hallucinations and delusions and all of these things go on. So I think that that's part of the point of the book, is to kind of have you feel all jumbled and weird and not really know what's going on for some of it, because that's what she's trying to portray so vividly to everybody. So, I mean, I understand what you guys are saying, but I think that that's the point.
Oh, no, I totally agree. I completely agree. My only issue with it is I think that before you realize what the point is, all the rest of it could be off-putting to a reader.
Yeah.
That's the only thing. And that's, like, only my ever concern when I'm reading a book like this, is just like, oh, how many people stopped reading this because they couldn't get past this weird plot or this annoying character or whatever it is. You know, which would be a shame, because I think it is a really good book and I think it's an important book to read. I'm glad that she wrote it. Like, it's so different from all the other YA stuff that's out.
Do you guys think that this is, I mean, this is kind of reductive, but do you think, like, Lauren Turned 17 would have been a better title and not, you know, kind of, I'm deliberately simplifying, but in terms of maybe not hinting one way or the other that something was happening, it's just kind of like Lauren turned 17 and then you kind of, because it is a major event in her life and the onset of her schizophrenia, but, you know, at the same time could be tied into, you know, the mythical stuff that she thinks is happening. I don't know.
No, I think Lauren Turned 17 is a lame title.
Yeah.
Sorry. I think 17 and Gone is the perfect title, because here's the whole concept of it. She's 17. She will no longer ever be the Lauren that she was before. She's gone. That Lauren is gone. She will never exist again. Because now she has to deal with all of these other things. Because that's the whole thing with, like, schizophrenia and certain types of mental illness. That you can't be even diagnosed with them until you reach a certain age. Because the label that's associated with them is so kind of heavy and permanent that you can't, they won't even give you the label until they're for certain that that's exactly what you have. So that's part of it as well. So she hits 17 and she is kind of pushed over the edge into this world of schizophrenia that she, I think probably all along as she was growing up, there were certain symptoms and signs of it, but it didn't fully manifest until she was past puberty, which is typical. So that's kind of why 17 and Gone is the title and why I think it works really well.
I really like the title. I think that's a perfect title. And I think, because kind of going off what you were saying, Jen, when you start reading the book, you just assume that the gone is referring to, like, kind of a physicality, like they're physically gone, they're taken, they're killed, whatever is going on. But it's by the end of it, you kind of think of it more as like a mental thing, you know, like 17 and changed or whatever. And it also has a kind of ominous feel to it. And it's really catchy. I like it.
Yeah, so why I think it is really catchy, and I think it just adds to that idea of sort of tricking you into thinking that, you know, it's all about the girls and that something really is going on with them and that they're actually being taken, and it's just one more thing to sort of make you feel at ease with this supernatural mystery that doesn't actually exist. And so, yeah, I really like it too.
Yeah, I think the title very well represents the kind of duality that's going on within the book. And again, it's one of those things that you can look at it more clearly in hindsight once you finished it.
Okay, so let's talk about the ending. You'd mentioned this a little bit earlier, Marma, about Fiona and why she's still the only one that Lauren sees. Do you guys have any theories or thoughts about that?
I think Fiona was the one person that Lauren always saw the clearest. And I think she was the one person she had the most connection to and felt guilty over because she was there when Fiona left. And so it doesn't really surprise me that she would be the one that Lauren sees even after she starts taking her pills and after she realizes what's going on. And I think she just has trouble letting go of the idea that this really is all in her head and it's not, you know, I mean, these girls obviously are gone. They were killed or kidnapped or ran away. But it isn't, you know, this strange monster that's coming and snatching them in the middle of the night. And I think she just has a lot of trouble setting that idea aside. And Fiona was kind of there, not the longest, because that was Abby, but she was always the strongest one that was present in her head. And they had conversations and they almost became friends after the fact, which is funny because obviously Fiona doesn't exist, but, or at least she doesn't exist as a ghost, I should say. She's all in Lauren's head, but yeah, I think she just didn't want to let go of this friend she sort of had ever since everything started happening.
I really didn't like it. Surprise, surprise. I understand, like, where you're coming from, Karen, and I think it's definitely deliberate that Fiona is the most fully formed of the girls because she's the only one that Lauren is basing the imagination off a real person and a person that she knows and has interacted with. All the other girls are imagined. So that's why they're kind of all a bit 2D and they've got their catchphrases and whatever, but Lauren doesn't really know anything. She's just making it up as she goes along. And so I really enjoyed Fiona as a character throughout the book because I think she kind of had this, kind of ominous and there was something kind of jarring about her presence because you knew that something traumatic had happened with Lauren to do with Fiona when she was much younger and Fiona being there just reminded you that something wasn't quite right there. But I really disliked her being there at the end because it made it, like, I'm not an expert on schizophrenia by any means, but it made it feel like Fiona was somehow outside of that. Like she wasn't part of the symptoms of schizophrenia or, you know, that it was okay. It seemed to be like it was okay that Fiona was still there, even though Lauren is dealing with a mental illness, which is like obviously something that's very serious. And she was dealing with this and she was, you know, on her meds or whatever else, but like Fiona was still there and that was fine. And, you know, we should be happy as a reader that Fiona was still around and was going to be hanging out with Lauren. So I think my issue was more with the way that I felt like it was being presented rather than the fact that she was there at the end, if that makes sense.
Yeah, no, I completely agree because at first, when I first finished reading it and I was still sort of processing this whole idea that she was schizophrenic, I was really confused because I was like, wait, is Fiona actually a ghost or what's going on? But at the same time, I kind of get why she's there too because it does show that medication isn't going to be a quick fix. I mean, these girls aren't, or at least Fiona isn't just going to disappear because now she's on medicine and, you know, everything is fine. This is something that Lauren's going to be struggling with every day for the rest of her life, whether or not she's on the medication. But yeah, I found it confusing and it kind of makes you stop and think, wait, is Fiona outside of all this? Does she actually exist as a ghost or is she part of the schizophrenia at the same time?
Well, yeah, sorry, I was just going to finish off. I think it also makes sense. It makes sense that she's kind of the last one to stick around because she's the strongest in a way. She's the one that Lauren feels the strongest connection to and probably has the most influence. I think that's fair to say, has the most influence over Lauren. But it just kind of felt like, and maybe this is just me projecting, but it felt like the author was trying to present it in a positive light, not as in, yes, this is a struggle, this is not a quick fix, you know, you can't take a pill and everything is better. But when I was reading it, and maybe I'll have to reread, it felt more like, but Fiona's here, so it's okay, and Fiona will always be here, and that's a good thing, and that bothered me.
Yeah, I mean, I agree. I think that it makes sense that Fiona is kind of the emblem of her schizophrenia, and that it makes sense that she's still there in the end, but especially because we don't really have that many reasons to like Fiona. You know, she's, other than what the real Fiona did to basically save Lauren's life when she was, how old was she, like 8 at the time, we don't, you know, she insults Lauren, she tries to get her to commit arson, she's all of Lauren's demons really embodied in this one character, and I totally agree with you, Marma. I also picked up on, at the end, like, that it was all good. Like, I might have this healthy presence of Jamie, you know, leave me at some point, and I'm not saying that Jamie necessarily needs to stick around in her life, that is up to interpretation, and they're teenagers and all that, but it sort of seemed like, it's okay, I'll always have my safe little, you know, my security blanket of Fiona to help her function through the world. And that sort of touches on something that bothered me a little bit about the book, and something that I'm also torn about, in that Lauren had such a negative, like a very, very negative view of the treatment of her schizophrenia. You know, when she's taken to the hospital after she tries to commit suicide, which is sort of clear, I think. I don't know. Did you guys get that she was trying to kill herself when she smashed the mirror?
I think it was pretty clear.
Yeah. So even though we're still in the mystery at that point, you know, it's clear that she needs help, and we have a whole thing of her thinking that her mother is an imposter and all that really, really scary stuff. But she's like, what do? You take that girl and you lock her up. And, you know, at the end, she's like, if I'm wrong, I'll swallow the pills, all, you know, everything that I'll do, everything they tell me to do. And while I completely understand that that's realistic for someone in Lauren's position, at the same time, I kind of feel like a book about schizophrenia should have slightly more of giving medication, like talk therapy and healthy treatments more of a fair shake, because at the end it sort of seemed like, well, I'm just going to go and be a sheep and do whatever they tell me, but I still have Fiona, and it's like,
But I, you know, think that's the point in a lot of ways. Schizophrenia isn't fixed by a pill. It isn't fixed by talk therapy. It isn't fixed by anything. It's very, very permanent. And these are the thoughts that people with schizophrenia would have. This is a constant. This doesn't, just because they're medicated or in therapy or in any of those things, it doesn't necessarily make it better. So it's a very realistic portrayal of what someone with schizophrenia and how they would respond to things, especially when they're first put into it all, how they would respond to medication and therapy and all the things that people are trying to do for them, because they're paranoid. They have voices telling them things that are different from what the positive light in their life is, and that's just the reality of it. And so I think that what she did was she stuck with the reality of the main character and not the reality of what the world would expect of that.
No, I realize that.
No, you go ahead.
Like, at the end, when, like, after the book, when there's the whole list of, like, you know, missing, like, numbers, helpful numbers for people, you know, it's like, if you are experiencing mental illness, call this number. And I'm like, if I'm a teenager and I think that I have, you know, schizophrenic symptoms,
from reading Lauren's situation, there's no way in hell I'm seeking help. And it's a complicated thing, because I agree with you, like, on a literary level, it's 100% the right thing to do. On a social level, I'm sort of not sure, and it's, you know, I don't know. It's not like I want her to be like, oh, and everything was okay now. Like, that's not what I'm implying or asking for, but I don't know. It's very confusing.
No, I think that's totally right, and it raises a really interesting question about the kind of responsibility that an artwork has if it's addressing issues like this. And I think the reason that 17 and Gone maybe stands out as much as it does is because the majority of YA fiction that addresses mental illness talks about depression, and it talks about depression in generally a fairly light way, like the person is maybe alienated, or, you know, they're sad, or they have a breakdown or something like that, and then it's fixed by the end of the book. It's generally fixed, or you get the feeling that it will be fixed in the future outside of the story. And so to have a book like this that both deals with something that is a lot more, I mean, like, I'm not ranking them, but certainly schizophrenia generally could be a lot harder to overcome than depression and things like that. Obviously depends on the person and circumstances, etc. But it is a very serious issue, and it's not often addressed. And then that, plus the fact that it is kind of set out in this way that is really hyper-realistic, could be, I don't know the answer to that question. I think you're right. For the story, it's maybe the right choice, but you read something like this and you think, well, you know, how many teenagers read this and think, oh, well, not even schizophrenia, like, oh, I feel sad sometimes, I feel really anxious sometimes, oh, well, I shouldn't worry about it, treatment is horrible, you know, blah, blah, blah. And I don't know the answer to that question, and I don't really feel one way or the other, but I think it's a book like this raises it, and it's an interesting thing to think about.
I actually have a quick question. So before the twist was revealed, what did you guys actually think was going on with the story?
I had no idea. I really didn't. I was, because, like I said, the Fiona thing kind of tipped me off that there was something quote-unquote real going on. But, the ghosts, like, and that they kept on coming, and that she had so much information about them, it was really confusing. And, you know, like I said, that's just not usually my cup of tea, so that's probably why I cheated.
Yeah, I'm kind of similar, I guess, when I was reading it, because schizophrenia is not something that's usually portrayed, I didn't immediately jump to thinking that's what it was, obviously. But I definitely, when I was reading it, did not think it was a supernatural thing. And I was like, I know something else is going on here, and I'm just going to have to keep reading to find out what it was. Because, and maybe this is just like from reading too much supernatural fiction, but it's very rare to read a book that only has one element of the supernatural or the fantastical, and everything else is like hyper-realistic. So when I was reading it, just, and this is probably a bad thing because I was kind of outside of the story, but I was thinking like, well, it's definitely no way it's supernatural because this is a hyper-realistic world. So there hasn't been any evidence that something like that can exist in this world. So I know something else is going on, and I will just have to wait and find out what that was.
Yeah, I didn't have any idea, but I agree with what Marima said. It didn't feel as supernatural as it should have if it was ghosts and things like that, so.
Okay, that's funny, because I had, like, a million different theories running through my head the whole time, because I was thinking, like, especially her mom, because what was going on with her mom was, like, I think she had a beauty mark on her face, and it kept switching sides, or, like, there'd be a tattoo that Lauren didn't think was there before, and her mom would say, you know, I don't have a new tattoo, and I was like, okay, is there some sort of, like, alien body snatcher thing going on, or, like, demons taking the form of her mother? And in The Lost Years of Merlin, there's this thing called a shifting wraith, and it takes on the form of something real. It looks absolutely identical, except it always has one fault. And so I kept thinking back to that, and I was thinking, okay, what's going on with this? And I think I was definitely, you know, thinking down those lines, and so I never really saw that there wasn't a whole lot of other supernatural things going on, and that's probably part of the reason why, once the twist was revealed, it kind of knocked me off my feet.
I have a question for you guys, actually, talking about the ending, because, this is on our doc, so I'm not going totally off track. Aside from Fiona being there, how did you guys think about the fact that Lauren knew about Abby and was able to save her, and even though everything else was in her mind, somehow she had this knowledge about that? Because I'm not sure about that part either.
You know, I think that Lauren is a very intelligent person and a very observant person, and I think that because we only meet her once she's started to fall into her schizophrenia, it's kind of hard to get a grip on that. But, you know, I mean, I think it's possible that going to the camp and, well, I mean, I guess she sees, but at the same time, she sort of says that Abby was different than she imagined her at the end, and her voice was different, and, you know, so I think it might be a combination of inventing a lot of the details and at the same time noticing certain things that might escape other people, and also caring, because it seemed like, you know, one of the things about this book was that a lot of people just didn't care. You know, 17-year-old girls go missing all the time. So I think that was maybe part of it.
Yeah, I think it harkens back to the fact that she was completely obsessed with these girls, and she did a lot of research, and she was looking into particularly Abby's past and trying to put all the clues together, and she was the one that was able to put all the clues together where other people had just given up. So I don't think there was anything supernatural going on top of, you know, the schizophrenia and that sort of thing. I think it was just the fact that she was the one willing to keep knocking on people's doors and tracking down these clues when everybody else had just assumed that she had ran away.
Oh, I do want to talk about how much, like, to what extent this book is an issue book. And I mean, more of the missing girl phenomenon than the schizophrenia issue in this case. Because schizophrenia is so personal, but, you know, she goes through all of these stories of these girls who, like, no one cares, you know, and their history is suspect, you know, or everybody's like, oh, well, she does this before, oh, well, her mother is crazy, oh, well, we don't like her anyway, oh, well, she's a whore, you know, all of these kind of excuses to write off girls as missing, and also the fact that they become legal, you know, in presumably less than a year if they go missing at 17. That I was, you know, and she has a line at the end, like, nobody deserves to be forgotten, and, you know, things like that. So did you guys think that that was well done, or kind of hammered home a bit? I'm still not sure how I feel about it.
Oh, now I feel like I missed something. But all those little kind of short story bits about the girl's backstory and things, I thought that was Lauren, like, making it up, because she thought that she knew all these girls, and she thought, you know, they have that conversation at the end that she has with Jamie where he brings her news of girls that have been found, or girls that, you know, like, not, like, Lauren thinks that they all died, like, there's the girl that froze to death in the house, and, you know, all of the various things, but most of them, what she thought happened to them didn't happen to them. In fact, what she thought happened to them didn't happen to any of them except for Abby and Fiona. So I just thought, I don't know, I guess I didn't see the sort of neglect side of it, because it was only Lauren's perception that she was the only one that cared about them. And the only ones that were really neglected to me were Abby and Fiona. And they're the only ones that she really knew about. Because I thought one of the most heartbreaking things in the whole book was that they found out that she'd been sending letters to the families of these girls that had disappeared. And I just thought that was, like, the saddest thing, because she obviously thinks she's doing the right thing by saying, like, oh, you know, this is what they'd want me to tell you, and, like, la la la. But you just think, like, how horrible would that be for the family receiving these letters from this girl that they've never met about their daughter that maybe they don't know where she is, or maybe she's fine, you know? So, I don't know. Did I miss that? Was that actually backstory, or was that Lauren's imagination? Because now I don't know.
Yeah, now I don't know either, because I mean, I agree with you. I think that's a good reading, but at the same time, I kind of wonder if there is... I mean, it was sort of in between, you know, like the girls who ran away to live together in Canada, like, they actually did that, you know, and so it's a weird combination of the details being accurate and the details being totally, completely off. So, I don't know. I do think, like, that her interactions with, you know, the real police officer are sort of telling in terms of the way that people think of missing girls, you know. I don't know.
Yeah, I know what you mean. I definitely agree about the police officer interactions. I suppose for me, when I was reading it, and now when I'm looking back on it, as far as an issues book goes, it's definitely more about schizophrenia than missing girls to me, because at the end of the day, the book was really about Lauren. It wasn't about the other girls. And yes, there was kind of Abby as a side story, and there was Fiona, which maybe the trauma that happened with her affected how her schizophrenia manifested. But at the end of the day, to me, that was what it was about. So, I don't know.
Well, I think part of it is about the missing girls, too, though.
Oh, yeah,
I mean,
of course.
It highlights a very interesting topic that, again, is never discussed, really. I mean, there's another book called Panic by Shannon Draper that actually addresses the issue about a teenage girl being kidnapped by a stranger and what that's like for that girl. You basically live the story through that girl's kidnapping. And how
that sounds horrible.
It was horrible. it's one of those really horrible books to, like... I mean, at the same time, I think it's an important book. It's also really dreadful to read and have to even think about those experiences for people. So, but yeah, there's that. Okay, well, that pretty much wraps up this episode of Book Hype. Thank you guys for listening. And of course, you can leave comments, questions, or chat with us at the Book Hype Twitter and on any of the book posts that you see on hypeable.com. So thanks again for listening. I'm Jen.
I'm Michal.
I'm Marima.
And I'm Karen.
Bye, guys.
Bye.
Bye.
Thanks.